I was still making my first survey of the interior of the Alfraz when Ricardo arrived, pedaling a large wheeled tricycle. There was a cage of woven wire fencing, empty at the moment, over the back wheels. When I heard Monica greet him, I stepped onto the ramp. "Come on up," I called. "It's not too bad." The pong of the dead worm was gone. I was still aware of the bleach, but leaving the ship open overnight with the ventilator circulating kept it from being a problem. I thought about the night for just an instant before my mind shied away. It had been a really long time since I'd been with Rachel. A lifetime. I didn't know what the future was going to be like. I suppose I should have been thankful for what had happened instead of worried about losing it again. But that wasn't how I felt. Ricardo took a look at the open knife switch and whistled. "Hey," he said, "that's bloody dangerous. You know, you ought to have the whole rig rewired rather than just replace the control circuit." "I do know that," I said, "and I will as soon as it's practical. For now, though, I just want to be able to fill with reaction mass and get home to Saguntum. There the new owners can upgrade the Alfraz." I didn't own the ship, after all. I wasn't sure who did. Platt wouldn't dispute my title, but perhaps the hegemony of Karst could. "Well, if that's what you want," Ricardo said. He looked sideways at me. "You know, if it's the cost..." "It's not," I said firmly. It was mostly a matter of time, though part of me was offended at the notion of spending a lot of money on a ship I didn't own. I was sure I could convince Monica to approve the work if I'd really wanted to. "Can you replace the control circuit or can't you?" Ricardo shrugged. "I'll be back this afternoon to do the job," he said. We went back out. He headed for his vehicle. I took a deep breath and walked to Monica, who was straightening the houseboat. I guess she was, anyway. "I'll be back this afternoon to fix it," I said. "Well, he says he will. I expect the pump to take about 6 hours to fill the tank from what I saw of the flow rate before it jammed. With luck, we'll be able to lift tomorrow morning." "That's very good," Monica said primly. "We'll need dinner then. I plan to go back to the same cafe to pick that up, but I'll bring something different. And I'll get fruit and bread and cheese right now, if that's all right."
"That's great," I said, trying to sound cheery.
It wouldn't have to be quite as spicy for me as last night. Though that's all right."
"All right," Monica said, nodding solemnly. She reached out and touched me on the back of my hand.
"Roy, are you all right? About us?"
I put my arms around her and kissed her.
"Monica, I didn't know how you'd feel and I was afraid."
She kissed me back, holding me hard. She started crying again, but she sounded happy. I didn't know where it was going to go in a moment. Well, yeah, I did know where it was going to go, but a group of men started up the quay toward us. Law was with three other guys. I turned Monica so that she could see them, then broke away and climbed up to the ramp.
"Good morning, Law," I called. "You're here earlier than I expected you. The repairs are supposed to be done this afternoon, and I hope we'll lift tomorrow morning."
Law cleared his throat and stepped out in front of his three companions. They were dressed in bright colored tunics and loose white slacks, more clothes than I'd ever seen Law wear. All four were slightly built, similarly dark and barefoot, however.
"Captain," Lal said, "we are short crewed, yes?"
"Yes, certainly," I said. "Are your friends spacers?"
"The Singh brothers are my compatriots from Kashgar," Lal said stiffly.
He didn't look over his shoulder at the three strangers.
"They will speak to you about their requirements."
He moved to the side and continued to stare straight ahead. More was going on than I understood. The man in the middle of the three strangers stepped ahead and crossed his hands behind his back.
"I am Rajiv Singh," he said. He was about 30. "I am a skilled astrogator. I and my brothers offer to take positions on your ship."
"We don't need a mate," I said. "We'll pay you as spacers, depending on your skill levels, on a voyage to Saguntum. I judge that to be about 14 days, though we might make better time with a full crew."
Rajiv frowned.
"You will pay us as able spacers?" he said.
"If you demonstrate that level of skill," I said, "we have close to 24 hours before we lift, so I'll run you through your paces here. If you perform as able spacers, we'll hire you at that rate."
I smiled slightly. I hadn't warmed to Rajiv, but we certainly did need crewmen.
"And we'll pay you for the day of testing."
The money didn't really matter. Emphasizing to Rajiv that I was in charge did matter. Rajiv moved back to his brothers. The three spoke in whispers. Rajiv returned and said,
"We will accept your positions, though I am due better."
"One moment," said Monica as she mounted the short rope ladder from the houseboat. "What was your last berth and why did you leave it?"
I will not take orders from a woman, Rajiv said to me in an angry voice.
You don't have to, I said. I'm the captain of the Afraz, like I'm sure Lal told you, only...
I smiled again. Monica, standing beside me now and sizzling like a pot on the boil as she listened, looked just a hair less furious.
You'd better at least be polite, because Mistress Smith is half-owner of the ship and is in charge of the money. Now answer the question or get the hell out of here.
We complained about the food on the Grandee, another Singh said. We do not eat meat, and the captain put us off the ship here.
Rajiv frowned but nodded agreement. What Rahul says is true, he said. The captain cursed us.
What we've got is what we could take aboard on Ben Yusuf, I said. I haven't checked it over, but I think a lot of it is meat, or it's been cooked in meat fat. If that's a problem, then...
We can bring our own food, Rajiv said, if you advance us our pay.
I motioned him back, then turned to Monica and whispered, I don't think they're going to run off if we advance them $20, and I'd like some help in the rigging. But I sure won't pretend I like the snotty bastard.
If they take the $20 and disappear, Monica replied, then it's better to learn it now than in space. I won't miss the $20 when we've reached home.
I nodded and faced the Singhs. All right, I said. If you've got the skills you claim, you're hired at able rates, and Mistress Monica will advance you money to buy food. Unless perhaps you're too proud to accept it from her hands. Instead of answering, Rajiv drew himself up straight. Test us then, and then give us our money for food.
I decided that was good enough.
All right, I said. I'll erect the dorsal antenna, and you can show me how quick you get it up and down. I went inside to the console. I put the brothers in air suits and sent them up the antenna. The topsail helpfully jammed, which it had twice done since we lifted from Ben Yusuf. The Singh shook it out in approved fashion. Sanjay wasn't really of able quality in the rigging, but he turned out to have at least as much knowledge of a fusion bottle as I did. Our unit had an integral display, but the bottle couldn't be observed from the console. That was a terrible situation, though it hadn't been a problem for us since we were keeping the cargo hold pressurized. The main hatch sealed well enough for that to work, though I disliked going into the hold to check readings. Given that the hatch between the cabin and hold wasn't an airlock, it would have been bloody impossible under some circumstances. I tried Rajiv on the console. His astrogation wasn't up to the standard expected of an entering second-year cadet at the academy, but he knew the basics. At the end of the morning, I told the Singhs to wait for a moment and join Monica, who'd returned from a shopping trip with Lal. If you're willing, I said, I recommend that we hire them. They'll save us about a day on our run to Saguntum. We'll clear rigging problems faster, and I don't have to recalibrate as often.
Monica shrugged.
If you think so, she said. Of course. Certainly getting home a day sooner appeals to me.
I called the brothers to us and hired them as able spacers while Lal watched. Monica then gave them an advance to buy food. I hadn't been considering Saguntum except as a destination. I thought further as I watched Monica hand each brother $7 and noted that it was an advance. Rejoining the Sunray's compliment might not be as simple as I'd been assuming. I was probably being carried on the books as run, meaning I'd left without permission or explanation. My story was simple and innocent. I was surely not the first spacer to get drunk on Liberty, but it sounded increasingly thin as I went over it in my mind. It only made sense if Maeve had deliberately sold me off-planet. I couldn't come up with a believable to me, reason that she should have done so. I wasn't looking forward to explaining to Captain Leary, and especially to Lady Mundy, that it had happened. When Monica had paid the Singhs their advance, a $5 coin and 2 ones, each, they went off. I said, I'm going to take Lal off to pick up more stores. Ricardo may be here before we get back, but he knows what to do, all right? She tried a smile. Aloud, she said, I'm looking forward to getting home.
Me too, I said, trying to sound more cheerful than I felt. But I'll settle for getting back to Saguntum.
Lal and I headed for Trident House, carrying one of the air suits between us. When Rajiv was running up and down the rigging, his suit's hip and torso section separated. A wrist joint I might have been willing to tape, possibly even a knee if we really needed to use the suit. Not the waist, though. I needed Lal to help with the load, but I also wanted a chance to talk with him. So, I said. I was carrying the front end of the suit, so I spoke back over my shoulder. Where did you meet the Singhs?
At the hostel where I'm staying, Lal said. They were being put out of it because they hadn't paid the rent. I paid for last night, and I said that I would introduce them to my captain.
They're not relatives, then? I said.
Law laughed. They would be very insulted to hear you say that, he said. They are of much higher status than I.
He laughed again.
Almost everyone is of higher status than I. Not you, of course.
Of course, I said.
And I gather the Singhs weren't too proud to accept your money?
That is their right, said Lal. I didn't hear any touch of emotion in his voice.
As it is my duty to offer such help as one of my class is able to offer to persons of theirs.
They're not friends, then, I said. Scarcely.
Bagnelli was in the back when we entered the shop, but the boy ran to the back and fetched him without needing to be told. He appeared, still chewing his lunch.
Roy, he called cheerfully. You have brought me a repair job, perhaps.
I brought you a trade-in, I said, and we want two refurbed air suits along with a few other items. We lift off tomorrow, Pietro. Heaven willing, and the creeks don't rise.
By the time we headed back to the Alfraz, it was getting toward evening. Lal was helping Bagnelli's boy with a cart, two air suits, and considerably more in the way of supplies. The boy would carry the partial hard suit back in the cart. The transaction wasn't quite a wash, but I wasn't pissing Monica's money away either.
Lal and the boy were chatting. I walked behind, thinking about Monica mostly. She was obviously somebody in Saguntum, and she probably had parents with ideas about who their daughter ought to be seeing. Spacers with 22 Alliance Tollers to their name weren't likely to be high on their list of suitors. At least I hadn't had to spend the 22 Tollers. I wasn't raking off any of Monica's credit chip, though. Frankly, I don't think my father would have either. Robbing the Republic wasn't the same as robbing your girlfriend. Monica was my girlfriend for now. For tonight. When we got to the Alfraz, the pump was already chugging, and Ricardo and his boy were loading their tricycle to leave.
It's been running 20 minutes, he told me. I turned it on and off twice from the console. I didn't touch that bloody switch on the box. I sure wish you'd have let me rewire that.
The next time I land on Plaque Mines, I said, shaking his hand. But I don't expect that to be any time soon. It occurred to me that I had at least a claim to the Alfraz. Worst case, and I didn't know how angry Captain Leary was going to be, I might be able to set up as captain of a tramp freighter. Because I wasn't in the RCN, he couldn't have me spaced as a deserter. I smiled vaguely. Ricardo took it as a friendly expression.
Well, I'll be happy to do the work, he said. He waved as he pedaled off with his son.
Lal and Bagnelli's boy were stowing away our purchases, leaving me alone with Monica. I cleared my throat and said, I expect our water tank to be full by midnight, though I'll check the flow in a minute to be sure. In the morning, you can look over the complete bill at Trident and sign. Then we're ready to lift as soon as the Singhs board, if they haven't done already.
I thought we'd use the houseboat again tonight, Monica said. If that's all right with you?
Yes, I said. Neither of us were looking the other in the face.
Yes.
I cleared my throat again and said.
I put the repairs on the bill to Trident. It's higher by Trident's profit that way, but Ricardo didn't know me from Adam. I think the whole business will run well under $1,000.
I trust you, Monica said. She smiled, but she still wasn't looking right at me.
Yes, I said again.
I prayed that I'd never give her reason not to.
Well, I'd better give the others a hand with the suits we're trading to Trident. The hard suit is pretty awkward.
I reached out and squeezed her hand. Then I went up the ramp to help Lal and the boy. Our crewman, the Singh brothers followed by Lal, walking two paces behind them, arrived shortly after dawn. I left the Singhs to strike down their gear. Thin bundles plus a wicker hamper of food, which Sanjay and Rahul carried between them, while Lal performed a final surface check of the rigging. Monica and I went to Trident to clear our account with Pietro. That was business, but it was also my last time alone with Monica before Saguntum and everything changing. That was how I felt about it anyway. I didn't say anything like that to her, of course. It was hard enough to frame the thought in my own mind. Saying it would make it real a week or so before it had to be. The charge from Monica's credit chip was 880 tollers. I was tempted to give Pietro another 50, but it wasn't my money, and I guess he knew what he was doing. When we returned to the Alfraz, I saw that the brothers had taken the three starboard bunks. I switched on the console, checked the readouts, and turned to the crew.
All right, I said, speaking to Rajiv, but sweeping all three with my eyes. While I prep for liftoff, the three of you remake the bunks. The bottom one, I pointed, is Mr. Smith's. Rajiv, since you seem to have stripped it, you'll remake it. You'll put your bedding on the top bunk in that rack. The middle one is Lal's, so you, Rahul, remake it for him. I've got the bottom bunk on the other stack, so you take either of the two that are open.
This is not right, Rajiv said in a furious voice.
It bloody well is, I said. Or you can get off the ship right now. Do you think you're on your own pisspot world still? Well, you're not. The Alfraz may not be Cinnabar, but it's going to be run like it is so long as I'm captain.
I wouldn't generally have talked like that, but seeing the bunks unmade and the bedding tossed onto the deck had lit my fuse. I was beginning to regret hiring the Sings.
Your choice, Rajiv, I said.
Didn't imagine that I could take all three, but Plaquemines had police. I was pretty sure that Pietro could find me help to put things right without going the formal route, too.
You are the captain, Rajiv said after a moment. He bowed slightly with his hands together. He and his brothers remade the bunks while I went over my course calculations again. I stayed at the console while the Alfraz accelerated out of orbit. Lal and the Singh brothers went out on the hull. There were only four suits, so I couldn't have joined them, even if I'd felt there was a reason to. Lal returned to report after half an hour, as I'd directed. The port mainsail had only deployed part way. The Sings were working on it. While I waited for them to return from the hull, I inserted a chip into the console and dipped into one of my purchases from Trident. Annotated charts of Region 37, Edition 12. It was the Alliance equivalent of the sailing directions. Pietro had said that the update was about 5 years old. We didn't really need it for a run to Saguntum, but I remember the horror I'd felt when I checked the console and found only cursory data on points directly between Karst and Ben Yusuf. I'd been diffident when I mentioned the charts as a possible expense to Monica, but she'd merely waved a hand and said, "Of course." I located the world where we'd touched down to fill the mass tank. The data was cursory, as I'd expected, regarding an uninhabited world. It mentioned dangerous sea life, though not the worms we'd had to deal with. The Sings came in from the hull about an hour later than I'd expected, from what Lal had told me of the situation. "Problems?" I said to Rajiv as he took his suit off.
"The starboard topsail yard doesn't extend properly," he said. "The motor is burned out, I think," Rahul added. "We hauled the yard into place, but this cannot go on. There must be repairs."
"I think I know what's wrong," I said.
"Well, get the suits off. Lal and I will go out after we've inserted." It sounded like my jury rig with the tower gear hadn't been as satisfactory as I'd hoped. I should have replaced it with a new part when we were in Plaquemines, but it had been working fine, and I'd forgotten about it. Monica got up from her bunk and bent over me at the console. "What does that mean?" she asked. She didn't sound exactly frightened, but I heard a perfectly reasonable note of concern in her voice. "If I can't fix it," I said, "and I may not be able to, it means I'll have to program our course for 3 working antennas instead of 4. That'll work. There's plenty of tram ships doing it right now, but it'll take longer because we can't transition between universes as smoothly as we should." I scowled and said, "Look, I screwed up. I should have got this looked at and fixed before we lifted." Monica patted me on the shoulder. "I didn't want to spend extra time on the ground," she said. She went back to her bunk. I checked the series of sail plan corrections to hold the course I'd chosen. It'd be 3 hours before the starboard topsail had to be furled, and after that I might be able to tweak the mainsail so that we didn't lose too much agility. Well, that was after I'd had a look at the problem. It might not be as bad as I was imagining anyway. Monica and the Sings were in their bunks. Lal was facing me through the display from the striker seat. "Crew," I said over the PA system, "prepare for insertion into the matrix. Inserting." I let the countdown clock actually execute the command while I watched. "Now." We shivered into the matrix. The Alfraz, cranky as she was in too many ways, had inserted slickly every time. Lal and I went out on the hull wearing the 2 refurbished air suits I'd gotten from Trident. Mine was stiffer than the trio which we'd found aboard the Alfraz when we took her over. I suppose that was good, though I'd have new scrapes and bruises tomorrow. Lal paused, looking out at the matrix. I stopped. I was on my way to the starboard antenna and did the same. It was the usual pastel wash, rather on the cooler end of the spectrum according to what my brain was telling me. Greens, blues, and even half-glimpsed violet.
I wondered if I'd ever understand the Matrix the way Captain Leary did. Probably not. It seemed to be something you felt, not something you learned. But Lal might have been able to talk to Captain Leary in terms they both understood. I opened the cover of the drive mechanism at the base of the starboard antenna. The clamp that held the tower gear in position had become loose. My removing the spring and snapping it back into place had weakened it. Now the drive gear rode over the teeth of what should have been the driven gear. There wasn't a spare on the Alfraz, of course. I laid my helmet alongside Lal's and said, "Go on back in. I want to stay out for a while." I was going to have to plot a course for three antennas. I didn't expect to gain major insights on the hull, but I'd learned a bit from Captain Leary. While Lal trudged to the airlock, I mounted to the dorsal main yard. I didn't see the face of the Divine in the color patterns, but I did get an inkling of a course. It was critical to keep as slight a change as possible in energy from each bubble universe to the next. So long as I could achieve that, our inability to dodge in and out quickly wouldn't be too big a handicap. I came in when my oxygen tank peeped at the last half hour. I'd been out less than 2 hours. There must be a problem with the tank or the suit, but that was still considerably longer than I'd intended. As usual, I took the helmet off in the lock. As I tramped in, working the catches of the suit, I said, "I think we'll be all right as is to Saguntum, though if we're making a lot less time than I looked up without attention. Rajiv faced me with a set expression. He was holding a small pistol. Rahul was at the back of the cabin, my own pistol, the one I'd thrown into the storage locker after Monica killed the consul with it, was in Rahul's hand, though he wasn't pointing it at anything. Monica lay on her bunk, roped to an upright. She spat out a wad of cloth and snarled, "They've mutinied! They're going to murder us!" "You will not be harmed," Rajiv said. "Do not resist, and you will both be delivered unharmed on a developed planet. We... don't reach for a tool. I will shoot you." I'd been thinking about rushing Rajiv, true, but I hadn't been reaching for a tool. I put my right hand flat on the bulkhead beside me, which was the only way I could be sure my arm wouldn't flop down toward a wrench hanging from my belt. I was about to be enslaved again. That would be something to talk about at cocktail parties when I got back to Cinnabar. If I ever went to another cocktail party... the invitations had stopped when Dad shot himself. If I ever got back to Cinnabar. "He's lying," Monica said. "They'll kill us." "No, no," I said. "They'll sell us for slaves. We're worth too much money for them to kill us." I was worth money. The lovely blonde Monica was worth a lot of money. I smiled warmly. I didn't think Rajiv would deliberately shoot me, but he was so bloody nervous that he might twitch off a shot without meaning to. If I calmed him down, then I'd have a chance to jump him. Rahul would certainly kill me if Rajiv didn't, but not before I managed to bang the snotty bastard's head on the deck plating. I couldn't help what happened after I was dead, but by heaven, I was going to take Rajiv, or at least his sense, with me. "Where are you going to sell us, Rajiv?" I said in a friendly voice. "I don't suggest Ben Yusuf, because they'd be likely to hang you and us both. You might be all right if you landed someplace else than Salaam. But I think you'd be better to try another planet."
"Lal," Monica said, "we can afford to replace another switch."
I hadn't been thinking about Lal, or Sanjay for that matter, who was watching Lal at the back end of the cabin. Lal was still wearing his suit. Rajiv must have grabbed him immediately, but held him out of the way until I entered, which they'd probably expected to be only minutes later. Lal turned and unlocked the internal hatch. "What's he doing?" Rajiv said when he heard the mechanism clack. He risked a glance over his shoulder, which gave me a chance that I didn't take.
"Sanjay, don't let the dog leave!"
Lal stepped into the cargo hold, pulling his arm away from Sanjay's half-hearted grip. Sanjay followed through the hatchway. Rajiv shouted,
"Rahul, shoot the dog! What is he doing?"
He wasn't more than half aware of me. I lifted my gauntlet half an inch off the bulkhead, though it shouldn't have mattered. All metal surfaces cracked blue in an instant before the cabin lights went out. Rajiv fired. My right arm jerked at a drop of fire. For a moment, the only illumination was the console display, an opalescence which didn't light anything around it. The emergency circuit closed and the cabin lights flickered on. The electrocuted corpses of Rajiv and Rahul dropped stiffly to the deck. Their pistols clanged sharply. I looked at my arm. The shot had missed me. Rajiv's muscles had clamped his finger on the trigger as he died. But the iridium pellet had splashed my arm with molten droplets of itself and the bulkhead both. The metal had melted through the air suit. I could patch it easily enough.
But there were undamaged suits for Lal and me now, and we were the whole crew again. Lal came in from the hold, holding the glowing wrench with which he'd shorted the switch. He looked dazed. He flung the wrench against the deck. The heat of the steel must have finally gotten through the gauntlet. I went over to Monica. Her hands and feet were still tied to stanchions so that she couldn't sit up. I was wobbly myself. There were burn patches on the soles of both of Rajiv's bare feet, but nothing like the extensive charring on the worm's hide from a similar jolt. It had done the job, though. I tried to untie Monica's legs, but I couldn't manage it, even after I'd taken my gauntlets off. The cable cutter was still hanging from my tool belt. It was awkward on ordinary rope, but a final jerk broke the last uncut fibers. I moved to her wrists.
"Thank you, Lal," Monica said. "I couldn't have survived that again. I would have killed myself."
"Mistress," Lal said, "you and the captain have treated me like a man, like your equal. The Singhs treated me like the dog they called me, as they would have done on Kashgar. Mistress, we were no longer on Kashgar."
I straightened as Monica shook off the tag ends of her bonds. "We're still in the Matrix, Lal," I said. "I think that's a good place to leave the Singhs. They can have a bubble universe all to themselves."
I changed my suit before I grabbed Rajiv's ankles and started dragging him to the airlock. After this, I could plot a course to a world with a repair yard. Chapter 29. I won't say we exactly needed the annotated charts after all, but it made my decision to set our course for Benedict easier than it would have been if I'd only had the notation Benedict alongside the coordinates in the console, the data on the Alfraz when we boarded it. I figured the course for 3 working antennas and the starboard ring telescoped and folded. Lal and I could have worked the topsail, but it would have been dangerous as well as brutally hard. We were better running crippled to a port 3 days away where we could get parts and repairs. If the rig were in proper form, I wouldn't have worried about not being able to refill the mast tank. I wasn't willing to trust a dicey rig and a non-working pump to the present very short crew of the Alfraz. Not if I had a choice, anyway. Monica smiled as I started to explain my reasoning to her.
"Roy," she said, "I want to know what we're doing. That's simple courtesy. But I don't need to know your professional reasoning. I'm not qualified to understand it, let alone judge it."
That was true enough. As with Lal, though, I'd have felt less alone if there'd been somebody I could discuss things with. The trouble was, there was nobody within 3 days' sail who could do that. If Monica refused to lift some of the responsibility that was mine alone, I should be thankful. Albeit really lonely. Lal and I went out together to check the clamps on the starboard rig. I'd given up on the notion of tweaking the mainsail to emulate the missing topsail when I considered that we were down to a crew of 2 again. A jammed mainsail would be a real problem if it couldn't be cleared immediately, and that job would take 3 spacers, or better, 4. In the airlock, before I put on my helmet, I said, "I appreciate what you did, Lal. I was about to jump, Rajiv. One of the other brother would have shot me."
"Captain," Lal said, "you saved my life, and you always have treated me like a man. What the Singhs would have done was on my honor because I brought them to you, even such as I have honor."
The air in the lock was getting thin. We both quickly put on our helmets, which ended the conversation. I squeezed his gauntleted hand before opening the lock, though. We made Benedict orbit in just within the 3 days I'd guessed. I was over 100,000 miles out when we got a microwave hail from a customs launch. "Benedict 1 to unidentified vessel. State your business. Over." "Monica," I said. She was on the striker seat, watching an image of the planet. "I'm trying to jump us closer in. Can you handle the commo?" I had a splitting headache, but she probably did also. We'd both feel better on the ground, so focusing on getting there was a win for everybody. "Freighter Alfraz out of Ben Yusuf requests permission to land in Howardport for refitting," Monica said. "Over." There were incremental jumps preset into the console, but they'd been calculated for a full rig. I doubt they'd have been much use to previous captains either, because very few tramps were operating with a full rig. Our present condition was extreme, but not unheard of, even on Cinnabar. "Benedict to Alfraz," the microwave said. "Say again you're leaving port. Over."
"Benedict, Captain Olfetri recaptured this ship from pirates in the port of Salam on Ben Yusuf," Monica said.
I could see tension on her face, but her voice seemed as calm as ever. "Do we have permission to land and refit? Over."
Response took almost a minute. The control vessel was obviously checking with superiors on the ground. As I finished my calculations, the microwave said, "Roger, Afraz, you may land in the berth you will be assigned in Howardport. Benedict 1, over." "Crew," I said, "we're making a positioning jump before we start braking to land. Preparing to insert now." My second extraction brought us out within 20,000 miles, which was almost too close. Howardport Control was marginally polite when it assigned us a landing space, and I wasn't surprised to see a pair of armored cars waiting on the quay when the steam had cooled enough for me to see anything through the ship's sensors. I opened the ship as promptly as I could and stood at the end of the ramp with my arms crossed behind my back, trying to look clean-cut and harmless. A bit to my surprise, Monica came and joined me. "I'm planning to be polite and agree with anything they say," I explained, while port personnel readied an extension from the quay to our outrigger. The Afraz didn't carry an extension of her own. I'd bought an inflatable boat in Plaquemines, but in this case the authorities certainly didn't want us traipsing into their city until they'd given us a thorough vetting. "Of course," said Monica with a touch of irritation. I noticed that the barrette was back in her hair. I didn't respond. I'd rather be accused of stating the obvious than I would of failing to give somebody necessary information that I'd thought was obvious. The port authorities were three civilians and four men wearing dull blue uniforms. Their carbines were slung, which was better than guns pointing at us. But I wondered if maybe we shouldn't have said we came from Karst. "My name's Hobbins," said the older male civilian. He was in his 50s and reasonably fit without being in the least athletic. "We're here to inspect your vessel and its cargo." I gave him a short bow, because from his tone I wasn't sure he'd accept my hand if I offered it. "Of course, sir," I said. "The ship is completely open. The console is live, and there are no protected sectors in it. We have no cargo, and there's only one spacer besides myself. His name's Lal, and he's from Kashgar." Hobbins nodded to his companions. The younger civilians went up the ramp, accompanied by two of the uniformed men. The other two stayed with Hobbins and us. "Would you like us to explain how we came to be here?" Monica volunteered. I'd been waiting for Hobbins to ask his next question. He smiled at her. "Ben Yusuf isn't a normal trading partner for Benedict," he said. "For us or for any civilized planet in this region. So yes, I would like to know." "Roy, you'd better tell him," Monica said. "I didn't know anything about it until we escaped." "Lal and I were spacers on the Martinique," I said. That was a lie, but not one that could be proved. "We were captured by pirates and taken to Salaam on Ben Yusuf. I was made a slave in the Admiral's palace. I met Mistress Smith there. She was a harem slave and wanted to escape home to Saguntum. With Lal's help, we captured a ship in the harbor and are in the process of sailing to Saguntum." I turned my hands up. "We had mechanical failures," I said, "which is scarcely surprising. We landed on Benedict for repairs, which we're able to pay for." "An admirably succinct account," Hobbins said, "but quite a remarkable one. You must be very resourceful people and very lucky." "If we make it to Saguntum," I said, "you can call us lucky." "No," said Monica sharply. "Roy, we're very lucky. I couldn't have lasted much longer in that place. At least I can die in clean air now." Hobbins looked at Monica oddly. "Mistress Smith," he said, "if I may ask you, how old are you?" "I'm 20," Monica said, meeting his eyes. Her voice was neutral, but neither of us knew where this was going. "In standard years, that is." Hobbins nodded. "The same age as my daughter," he said. "Well, let's go aboard your ship and see what my colleagues have found. Nothing that will help do much for your customs receipts, I'm afraid," I said as we walked up the ramp. The two guards, armed police, followed us without comment. "All we have is food for the voyage." "My colleagues are from Tax and Customs," Hobbins said calmly. "I, on the other hand, am in the Directorate of External Affairs." I stubbed my toe on the ramp and stumbled. I looked at Hobbins closely. "Pretty high up, I would guess," I said. He smiled but continued to look ahead. "I'm not a politician," he said. "A business involving the pirates of Ben Yusuf was going to land on my desk eventually, so I decided I'd take a hand at once." Aboard the Afraz, Lal stood silently in a corner of the cabin while the civilians were at both positions of the console. The woman on the couch at the main display turned her head and said, "Sir, according to the log they lifted from Ben Yusuf, touched on a world that's just an alphanumeric, then Plaquemines, and finally here. No indication of piracy or, for that matter, anything else." "Logs can be doctored," said the young man civilian on the striker's seat, "and there are two guns in the locker." "Logs can't be doctored by me," I said.
I was probably a little hotter than I should have been, but it was a nonsense claim. And yeah, there are two pistols in the locker. Are there any tramps in this region that wouldn't be true about? Before the customs man could respond, Hobbins raised his hand. I don't believe we're dealing with pirates, Rawlins, he said. A pair of very fortunate young people, it seems to me. As an afterthought, he glanced at Lull and smiled. And their crewmen. Well, Darlene and I have been told that this is in your hands, sir, said the male customs man. He stepped away from the console. Yes, said Hobbins, it is. He looked at me and said, Captain Olfetri, what are your plans now? Well, if we're free to leave the ship, I said, I'll see about getting a replacement tower gear and an electrician to rewire the switch that I damaged in electrocuting an animal that crawled aboard while we were taking on water. Can you recommend a ship, Chandler? I can't, Hobbins said, but I believe... He glanced toward the other civilians. The woman said, Sir, my brother's a partner in LaJoy and Company. They've got a good reputation. Yeah, they're okay, said her male colleague, possibly trying to make up for his earlier behavior. Then Mr. Smith and I will check with LaJoy, I said. Are Alliance Tollers good on Benedict? They pass as current here, Hobbins said, and you are free to go, yes. I'd like to get some food, Monica said, particularly fresh fruit. I can see stands on the waterfront. Roy, you don't need me to take care of the repairs. Then I hope your business on Benedict will be successful, Hobbins said, making a little bow. It's been a pleasure to meet you both. I let out a deep breath. It had certainly been a pleasure to meet him. I probably could have found my way to LaJoy and Company myself, but Darlene said she was off duty now and guided me there. Not only did they take tollers, I thought to ask about the karst sequins I'd brought from Ben Yusuf. I was able to get rid of those as well. I was feeling pretty pleased with life as I ambled back to the Afraz, carrying the replacement tower gear. It was heavy enough to switch from one hand to the other, but not heavy enough that I regretted leaving Lal with the ship. I'd offered him liberty until the next morning, but he'd said he'd rather stay. He was still embarrassed about the Sings, though there was no reason. I'd been the one to hire them, and Monica had agreed. There were two vehicles parked on the quay as I returned from the Chandlery. One was a little Port Authority jitney with a saddle in front, on which the driver still sat, and a bench over the back wheels that would hold two if they were friends. The other was a four-wheeled gray car with an ID legend stenciled in black and the name HKS Meduse. The car might be armored, but the pintle in the center was empty. It was obviously meant to support an automatic impeller or a missile launcher. People stood in the hold of the Alfraz, though nobody was shouting and I didn't see weapons. I stopped beside the driver dozing on the jitney and tapped him on the shoulder. You've got commo on this, I said. Use it to raise the Directorate of External Affairs and tell Master Hobbins that there's trouble at the Afraz. I think the car's destroyer in harbor is trying to pull something. What? The driver said. Who are you? I don't have anything to do with external affairs. I'm Captain Olfetri of Cinnabar, I said truthfully. And you won't have anything to do with any bloody government job if you don't pass the warning on to Master Hobbins before it blows up into a real crisis. I walked up the ramp, whistling, Don't You Remember, Sweet Alice, and holding the paper-wrapped gear in the crook of my left arm. I'd spoken to the driver with certainty. The only thing I was really certain about was that I was out of my depth. That was getting to be the usual thing. That realization made me smile. Good afternoon, gentlemen, I said as I approached the hatch. A woman in a blue uniform stepped out of the cabin to look at me. And, madam, I said, entering the hold. I'm Captain Olfetri. May I ask the purpose of your visit? Lal stood in the hold also, along with a man in a khaki uniform like that of the driver of the jitney. I handed the gear to Lal and said, I want this installed soonest. I'll be along to help as soon as I get free. But on the ground it shouldn't be much of a job even for you alone. Captain, Lal said, they say we have stolen the ship. I clapped Lull on the shoulder. That's above your pay grade, I said, smiling. Get to work on the rig and I'll discuss the situation with our visitors. Two blue-uniformed men came out of the cabin, followed by Monica. Her face was still. You're in command, one of the men said. The silver script of his name tag was too worn for me to read it. He turned to the Port Authority man in the hold and called, Superintendent, I want this man arrested as a pirate. Sir, I said to the superintendent. I've just asked your driver to inform Master Hobbins of external affairs about the situation and asked him to intervene. You might check on your man and make sure he's done that. I fear he didn't understand how much trouble he'll get your department in if you try to handle this on your own. The other male Karst officer was older than his colleague, 40 or so, but he had hollow circles in place of pips on his collar and was obviously subordinate. He looked from me to the first man and said, "I know the Alfraz. I was her captain until I sold her to the government and joined the Navy. She's a Karst ship." "She may well have been," I said, stepping past the Karst officers to get into the cabin. "The Ben Yusuf pirates steal from anybody, as I understand it. Mistress Smith and I captured it from the pirates at Salaam and escaped with it. I'm perfectly willing to have the matter of ownership determined in court, but..." I smiled at the Karst officers as I put my hand on the airlock controls. "On Saguntum, please. Mistress Smith is a citizen, and I'm an officer of the Republic of Cinnabar Navy, who was shanghaied off my ship there." I didn't open the locker to get tools out. Lal had been wearing his belt when I ordered him to get to work on the antenna, which should be enough. My real concern was to get away from the Medusa's officers until Hobbins or some other high-ranking local arrived. That might be hours. Before I could move into the lock, on the surface the only way onto the hull was up a ladder welded onto the hull, an air car passed over the Alfraz, moving low and slow. I heard it circle and moments later land on the quay. Thank goodness. "Gentlemen and m'lady," I said, passing the car's personnel in the other direction. "I believe that will be the Benedict officials we've been waiting for." I certainly hoped so, anyway. I led Monica and our visitors to the boarding ramp. Master Hobbins was already on the extension walkway, walking briskly toward us. "Sir," I said, bracing myself to attention. Hobbins didn't have military rank, but I wanted to impress on the Karst officials that he was important. "Midshipman Olfetri, acting captain of the Alfraz, welcomes you aboard." "Sir," said the Medusa's captain. "The Alfraz is a Karst ship, and this fellow, whoever he is, isn't captain of her." "You'd be Lieutenant Sisk of the Medusa, I believe," Hobbins said. His voice was calm but not warm. Yes, sir, I am," the Karst officer said. "My sailing master here recognizes her." "Yes, sir, I do," the older officer said. The female officer hadn't said a word that I'd heard since boarding. "I was her captain, I was, sir." "And you're saying that Captain Olfetri did not capture the Alfraz on Ben Yusuf, Lieutenant?" Hobbins said. "Because you should know that my experts have examined the ship's log and found that she did in fact lift from Salaam on Ben Yusuf and proceed here with only two short intermediate stops." "Well, that may be," said Sisk, obviously taken aback, "but she's still a Karst ship." "I don't doubt that," Hobbins said. "And it should be easy to prove in Admiralty Court. Though there would of course be compensation to Captain Olfetri if he's proved to have retrieved the vessel from pirates. But that is a matter for the court to decide, Lieutenant, not for a bureaucratic flunky like the port superintendent here." He nodded to the man in khaki, who avoided meeting Hobbins's eyes. "Well, what do you propose to do about it?" Sisk said. "You can't try throwing your weight around with me, you know." "I propose," Hobbins said, without emphasis on the repeated word, "to wait for a court to determine ownership issues, and to prevent breaches of the peace from occurring on Benedict. I believe the hegemony of Karst has friendly relations with Saguntum, does it not?" "Of course we do," said Sisk, "but that doesn't mean that Saguntine citizens can steal our property." "Of course not, Lieutenant," Hobbins said, nodding. "But if I may make a suggestion, you're a naval man used to the cut and thrust of battle. Perhaps it would be a good idea for you to confer with the Karst advisor in the city, rather than to take matters into your own hands. I think we might all avoid embarrassment if you were to take that line." Sisk stood without moving for a long moment. Then he nodded curtly and said, "Come on, Byerly, Hesketh, we're going back to the ship." He strode down the ramp with his subordinates in tow. I watched silently for a moment, then turned and said to Master Hobbins, "Thank you, sir. If it's all right with you, I'll go up on the hull to help Lal." "May I ask how long will it take you to complete the task?" Hobbins said. I shrugged. "Less than an hour," I said. "Probably a lot less. But an electrician is coming tomorrow to give us an estimate on the switch replacement." "Is that necessary?" "Not necessary, no," I said. "If we've got the rig complete again. But it'll be a lot safer to be able to use the pump." "Captain Olfetri," Hobbins said with a cold smile, "it will be much safer for you to be off-planet immediately. The Karst advisor would be very embarrassed if the crew of the Medusa were to capture the Alfraz by force and hang her crew. But realistically, I couldn't do anything but write a stiff note if that happened. Karst is the power in this region." Monica said, "Thank you, sir. I have full confidence in Captain Olfetri's ability to reach Saguntum without taking on additional water.
We'll leave as soon as the antenna is repaired and port control gives us authorization.
You have your authorization now, Hobbin said, bowing to her. And I'll see to it that no other ship lifts from Howard Port until the Alfraz has entered the Matrix.
He strode briskly down the ramp. The port personnel in their jitney and the car from the Medusa had already pulled away.
I kissed Monica. I'll see how Lal is coming along, I said. Soon.
I was really looking forward to making Saguntum.
Chapter 30. We made our first insertion into the Matrix when we were only 3 hours out from Benedict. Much sooner than I'd have chosen if I hadn't needed to vanish as quickly as possible. I could only add velocity in normal space. I could adjust that velocity relative to normal space in bubble universes, where constants of time, velocity, and distance varied. When we extracted into normal space, our location could be very much farther from our point of insertion than would have been the case if we'd remained in normal space the whole time. That said, the faster we were going when we inserted, the multiplication within the matrix was greater in absolute terms. Master Hobbins had laid the reason for getting away quickly on the personal safety of the Alfraz and her crew. That was certainly real, but there was also a serious risk to Hobbins and to Benedict. From a Cinnabar viewpoint, my viewpoint, Karst was a very minor power. To independent planets in the immediate region, however, Karst was more important than Cinnabar, or even than the Alliance, which had a greater local presence than we did. Master Hobbins had been very supportive. I didn't want to cause him needless problems by remaining in the vicinity. All things considered, the rig behaved properly. That said, Lal and I spent more time on the hull than we did in the cabin. He didn't complain, and I found I was coming to like it. Being immersed in the Matrix made it familiar to me and even welcoming. I was beginning to notice the minuscule changes in apparent color from one viewing to another. This was all in my mind because visible light didn't exist beyond the ship's individual bubble, but it did indicate relative energy states and relative changes. I came in feeling tired but good. Lal was asleep on his bunk. We'd been taking solo watches because there really wasn't any choice. We had enough experience with the air suits to be willing to trust them, and I'd insisted that Lal use a safety line the way I did. I think my concern puzzled him, but I was the captain. Monica got off the couch at the console's main screen and moved around to the striker seat. "The rig is well," she said, an excuse to speak. I twitched the ventral alignment a notch and squirted some graphite in the race, I said as I took my suit off. I ached pretty generally, as I usually did now, and I knew I'd be feeling today's work in my rib muscles tomorrow morning. It's worn, but I think it'll get us to Saguntum fine. I needed a shower, a meal, and some sleep, but first I wanted to check our position in the sidereal universe. There were two opinions on going through extraction while you were asleep. The majority feeling was that the effect stayed with you longer. That was me in spades. Some folks, 1 in 10 or so, missed the effects completely if they were asleep. Lal was in the minority and slept through the extractions unaware. Monica and I weren't so lucky. I glanced at my course projection and said, "Prepare to extract in 5 seconds. 3, 2, 1, now." I slid down through a bath of cold water and came out the other side shivering but unharmed a few seconds later. Monica, on the other hand, gasped so loudly that she awakened Lal. She had to cling to the console to keep from falling off her seat. I engaged the high drive and compared our real position with the position I'd calculated when I set the course. I was sorry for Monica, but there was nothing I could do. And goodness knows I've had miserable extractions also. Astrogation was my job, and to my delight we were remarkably close to where we should have been in the sidereal universe. I was feeling pretty good about that. Sure, I knew it meant that my errors were canceling one another out, but being lucky is even better than being good. Well, I've heard guys say that. I got up from the console and said to Lal, "We're spot on for the moment. I'm going to check the fusion bottle before I calculate the sail plan for the next insertion." I spoke loudly so that Lal could understand me over the high drive. Monica could hear also, but I was pretty sure nothing was going to penetrate her consciousness in her present condition. We were accelerating at 1.5G, the best the Alfraz was capable of with the high drive alone. While we weren't really short of reaction mass, we had no means of replenishing it. I wasn't going to use what we had in a wasteful fashion. I walked heavily to the internal hatch, opened it, and stepped over the combing with great care.
I could move easily enough, but simply raising my boot higher than usual and taking a step required deliberation. The readout was on a box at head height, on the side of the fusion bottle. I tapped the switch to illuminate the readout. I was also considering how I would modify the console's book solution for our next insertion. The needle was well into the red. In the split second while I took in the fact, the needle dropped back toward the bottom of the yellow zone and quivered there. What in hell am I going to do now? The needle was beginning to rise again in tiny, trembling increments. I tramped back to the console. "Oh, that was a bad one," Monica said, trying to smile at me. "Monica," I said, "I need you to go into the hold and watch the display on the fusion bottle. Don't worry about the numbers, just the green, yellow, red readout. Tell me what the needle's doing." She went to the hold, taking Law with her. I thought she needed help walking under acceleration, but I didn't ask. I cut back the high drive to 1G. There hadn't been a problem until now. I hadn't been checking the bottle constantly, but I had checked whenever I thought about it. Maybe hourly when we'd been in sidereal space, or at least every couple or 3 hours. The power usage to feed the high drive, converting normal matter to antimatter, which provided thrust when it combined with normal matter in the motors, was the greatest draw a starship put on its fusion bottle. Running the converters at high rate shouldn't have been an overload, but it was the only thing I could change. Lal reappeared at my shoulder, offering a note. When I realized what he was doing, I snatched it out of his hand and read, "In yellow, 1/8 inch above green." The block printing was the same as I remembered Monica using when she wrote cards for me to read through the palace cameras. I nodded to Lal and thumbed him back toward the hold. Then I returned to my course calculations. Rather than try to shout over the high drive, Monica was using Lal as a messenger. RCN Como helmets would have made the job much easier, but having a real engineer, and for that matter regular RCN maintenance, would have been better yet. Failing those things, having somebody as sharp as Monica was the best I could imagine. I didn't have my third-year rotation on power room practice at the academy. I'm sure there'd have been a lot of information beyond the basics I'd gotten in my first-year introduction, but I was also pretty sure that fixing a bottle that fluctuated as badly as ours had was beyond anything I'd be able to handle if I'd graduated as a midshipman. This was the sort of problem that only a long-service expert like Chief Pasternak could diagnose. And even a Pasternak might say that the answer was to shut down the fusion bottle and replace it immediately. Law came with another note. Needle unstable, but on average had dropped slightly. I nodded and continued to work. We didn't have the option of shutting down and replacing the bottle. We were many light years away from the nearest replacement. I finished my calculations and entered the course, including the point at which we would insert. If I died this minute, the Alfraz would still execute my commands. When Law came with a third note, I took it but rose from the couch and went into the hold to join Monica. She looked up, startled. We could talk when we were this close. "Is it all right?" she said. I nodded. "It's as good as I can make it," I said. The needle was below where it had been when I first noticed the problem, but it hadn't dropped into the green as I'd hoped it would. "We'll insert in 14 minutes, probably 13 by now. And the bottle will basically be at standby until we engage the high drive again. I think we'll be okay." Intellectually, that was true. My gut didn't think it was going to be fine, but it was no smarter than the gut of any other frightened kid. Frightened young man, I suppose, but I wasn't feeling very manly. "So we continue as we've been doing then?" Monica said. She was just asking a question, not protesting, not complaining. She wanted to know what the situation was. "Not exactly," I said. There were two things different going on when I noticed the problem with the bottle. I'd raised it to maximum output to accelerate on high drive. When I cut it back, the bottle settled down pretty well. The other thing I did, though, was to extract from the matrix. "What does extracting do?" Monica said. We were both watching the needle. There were 6 separate windows below that. The multi-digit numbers on each ran up and down in quick bursts, like startled roaches. It was going up again, not fast, but definitely the wrong direction. "It shouldn't do anything," I said. "But nothing we're doing should be a problem. This fusion bottle was intended for a bigger ship than ours. Our 6 motors shouldn't have stressed it. Wouldn't have stressed it if it was working the way it ought to be." "Will we be able to get to Saguntum?" Monica said. "We should," I said. "We could get back to Benedict faster." "What will happen to us if we run out of power in the Matrix?" Monica said. Her voice sounded perfectly calm, but her eyes were wide open and terrified.
That can't happen, I said, smiling brightly. We're at risk of a high-end failure, not a shutdown.
If the bottle fails, it'll convert everything inside the hull into plasma in a heartbeat. Probably most of the hull, too.
Monica giggled.
Well, that's all right, then, she said. She sounded like she meant it. I don't want to go back to Benedict.
The other thing, I said, leading her back into the cabin with me. We were getting close to when I'd set the console to insert, having based the course calculations on our velocity at that time. The other thing is that we'll be trying to reach Saguntum in a single run, instead of breaking it into three as I'd planned.
But that's good, isn't it? Monica said as she settled onto her couch. Law was already on the striker seat of the console.
It's good if my astrogation's better than I think it is, I said. I'll have my fingers crossed.
But it means we'll be in the Matrix for 7 days straight, because our sidereal velocity's not as high as I'd like it to be. There's stories about long insertions causing folks to see things. Nothing harmful, but, well, really odd.
People who came back into the normal universe hadn't been harmed. What might have happened to folks who hadn't extracted? Well, there was nobody to say.
It'll give us something to tell people about when we're back on Saguntum, Monica said.
I settled onto my couch. The high drive shut off automatically as we prepared to insert. If either Monica or I was as cheerful about our prospects as we sounded, we were nuts.
Inserting, I said. We rippled out of the normal universe.
I can't describe the next week. Looking back on it, everything was clear and sharp for the first day or two, but after that the world lost its edges. The work on the hull was hard from the beginning. After a while it crushed me flat. I no more thought about it than I thought about breathing. The rig ceased to be antennas, cables, and sails. It became a pattern. When something went askew with the pattern, it glowed red in my mind until I'd put it right. I'd heard spacers talk about seeing alien ghosts during long runs in the Matrix. One night, Barnes and Dossie had described things they'd seen on a 20-day run in the corridors of Captain Leary's Corvette, the Princess Cecile, and sometimes walking through bulkheads. I didn't see anything like that, but by the end of the week, I had become part of the Alfraz. I was a machine working the sails while I was awake, and when I slept, my dreams were still out on the hull. I'd just come down from checking the set of the ventral topgallant when the Matrix shimmered brightly an instant before going coldly dark. Around me were the stars of the sidereal universe. The Alfraz had extracted without me being aware what was about to happen. We were in normal space again, my head didn't hurt, and I felt none of the usual discomforts of the process. I looked around for Lal and didn't see him. I couldn't remember whether I'd ever seen him during this insertion. I found the airlock and entered it. Only when the green light went on, indicating that the air pressure had reached that of the cabin, did I remember to take off my helmet and go in. I stepped over to the console, still wearing my air suit. Lal was curled up on his bunk. Monica watched me from hers with an expression I couldn't read. I said to her, I'm going to see how close we've come to where we're supposed to be. I just hope we're close enough that the console can locate us. The fusion bottle has stayed in the green most of the time that we've been in the Matrix, she said. Then, not quite in the same tone, she said, you're speaking to me again, then?
What? I said,
setting the console to search and identify our location.
I'm not mad at you. I've just been busy, for heaven's sake.
My skin was rubbed raw everywhere it touched the inside of the suit, which felt by now like my whole bloody body. Her question hit me the same way.
You haven't spoken to me for 4 days, Roy, Monica said. I thought I must have done something wrong.
You didn't, I said. I guess I've just gone nuts. I was too tired to care, though I was sure I'd be horrified at my behavior when I had at least two brain cells sparking together. I looked at what the console told me about our location.
Well, I'll be damned.
Monica came over and stood beside my couch. I looked up at her and said,
if this is right, we're within a light hour of Saguntum.
That's very good, she said.
Why are you looking so worried?
It's too good, I said.
Look, you say I haven't spoken in 4 days. I haven't been properly conscious for 4 days. I can't have been responding to the semaphore prompts. In fact, I don't remember looking at the towers a single time since...
at all.
But I must have done at least at the beginning of the run.
What I remembered was the way the rigging glowed red if it wasn't set right, and me trudging up and down the length of the ship, fixing whatever wasn't as it should be. I felt my lips smile as I continued to enter course calculations. Without looking at Monica, I said, I felt I was part of the ship myself there toward the end. I guess maybe that's not a bad way to be for a spacer.